This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Everyone, this is Lynn Marie Norris with Radioactive Magazine on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Today I'll be talking to people from Cultivate KC, a nonprofit organization that began in 2005 with the goal of promoting urban agriculture, the growing of foods in city neighborhoods to feed other people. We'll talk about the benefits of local food, why Cultivate KC supports urban farmers, and the importance of building up our local food system in relation to resilience to climate change. With me today are Catherine Kelly, Mark Gowron, and Dan Krull. Hi.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
So starting with Catherine Kelly, you are the executive director and a co-founder?
A co-founder of the organization. I have done community-based work my whole life. I grew up on farms, I gardened, and in 2005 made the decision to integrate all that, and so we co-founded what was then the Kansas City Center for Urban Agriculture.
Wonderful. And then, Mark, you are the manager of the farms and food systems at Cultivate KC?
Yes, so I work with the Metro farmers and travel around quite a bit of the city, supplying technical assistance to local farmers or graduates of the refugee farm. I've been loosely involved, I suppose, or more in-depthly involved in the hort agriculture world for the past 16 years, working for K-State Research and Extension and Powell Gardens.
That sounds great. And last but not least, Dan Krull.
I'm the farm manager for the Westport Commons Farm, which is the new farm for Cultivate KC, and I oversee all the volunteers who work on the site, and I'm currently working to improve the soil to get it ready for vegetable production.
Sounds exciting. Well, thank you all for being here today. And just for our listeners, I guess we ought to start out by talking about what are the benefits of growing food organically?
So organic agriculture is going to have many benefits. You're going to limit your exposure to pesticides. You're going to have a healthier, overall more sustainable food system in the long run. Organic agriculture reaches a good balance in our ecosystem with healthy soils, positive pest influence in the environment that can often solve a lot of our problems. It doesn't mean that it's easy or isn't extremely difficult to do organic agriculture, but in the long run, for our sustainable existence as human beings, it's the route to go.
It makes a lot of sense. So why isn't it also important that you not just eat organically, but that the food be locally produced?
Money spent locally stays in our community. Beyond that, there's going to be various benefits to that. The food being fresher is going to be better for you. As soon as food is cut, the vitamin, the nutrient density starts to degrade. So the fresher that food is, from a consumer standpoint, the better that food is for you. Plus, you're cutting down on the miles, the carbon footprint that food travels.
When you're selecting the varietal, the type of fruit or vegetable that you're growing, when you're selecting to see what survives shipping, you're not selecting for flavor or nutrient density or any of the things that we want in our mouth. Whereas if I'm growing it locally, I can pick a tomato that's the most delicious tomato as opposed to the tomato that's going to survive, you know, 1,500-mile journey in a crate. So that's one of the huge benefits. You get better flavored food and usually more nutrient-dense food.
And you know where your food came from.
You can go visit the farm, see what the farmers' practices are, meet their family, get engaged. So there's some sort of secondary benefits as well.
Yeah, and that sounds really exciting. Well, I think also the less carbon footprint is important too, because you think about how much things are shipped to get here.
Our shipping system and the way that we handle our food currently ends up wasting, you know, I would say somewhere in the range of 50 to 60% of the food we produce. You'll hear it commonly said 30%, but that food that comes in, if it's damaged, if it doesn't look perfect, it gets thrown in the garbage. And millions and millions and millions of pounds of very, very edible food gets thrown away every day because it's not perfect for the grocery store shelf, and a lot of the damage that goes into that goes while it's being shipped.
So why does Cultivate KC support urban farming?
So our food system, we will always have and need gardeners. We will also always have and need farmers. Farmers grow food for people who don't have the time to, don't have the inclination to. So farming is an important keystone for our food system. And we support urban farmers because one of the things that has happened as more and more of us have crowded into cities is that we've gotten disconnected from agriculture. And so reconnecting people to agriculture in their neighborhood is a way of helping people better understand where their food comes from, what hard work it is to produce it, and why they should care about it.
So how is climate change affecting farming in Kansas City?
It's impacting us at a number of levels. First off, the weather has gotten crazy. It's 80 degrees one day and 30 degrees the next day. And that's really stressful for the farmer. It's really stressful for the plants. Plants under those circumstances wig out, thinking, oh my God, I need to set seed and reproduce before, you know, more happens. And so plants don't get to their full growth before they start trying to reproduce. It also affects farmers by just making it harder to be outside when it's really cold, when it's really windy, when it's raining at farmers markets. It has a physical stress component to it. It makes your yields less predictable, which means that your profitability, which is already in farming a pretty fine to no margin, it really affects your ability to predict how many pounds or, you know, or types of products you'll be able to grow, and that affects your farm business sustainability from an economic perspective.
I would say the Midwest is already really hard environment to grow crops in. We already are volatile in our swings just from the nature of where we're at. Spring comes earlier, but you still have the freeze, so your timing of when you have to get crops in is affected. 90% of our rainfall happens in 10 days. So large rain events like that can really ruin your ability to either establish a crop, or if it happens at a harvest time, to ruin a crop. So those kind of events, if they happen more frequently, just makes your job harder.
As temperatures continue to rise, they're supposed to be hotter overnight. We're supposed to have more 90-degree days above 90 degrees in a row than we have historically had. When that happens, plants don't set fruit. They'll do what's called blossom drop. So you'll have a plant that's growing but absolutely no fruit on it. New pests are invading because of the heat. So we're seeing pressure from pests that have normally been more to the south of us and to the southeast of us showing up. Diseases become more prevalent. When you get, you know, massive downpours of rain, you get fungus buildup, and so there, you know, so diseases are increasingly problematic for a bunch of different types of plants.
We had more freeze thaw cycles than we have in the past. I heard a lot of farmers say they lost a lot of garlic this year. Garlic's planted in the fall. When you have a lot of freeze thaw, it can tear the roots away from the bowl.
Two of our major cereal crops also are planted in the fall, winter wheat and cereal rye.
So it's not just how the summer is, it's all year round how the climate is.
A lot of the things that organic farmers do and a lot of the things that Cultivate is touting and trying to demonstrate and teach people, including farming in the city and being more versatile with our food system, people are starting to wake up to it because they're realizing just how difficult it's going to be to farm conventionally when the climate starts to shift. Now, if you have really healthy soil, and if you have a stable local food system, then you're ready, you're more prepared for the tragedies that can happen when the climate changes. And
it's not just us. I mean, imagine the amount of food that is shipped into us from California, which California supplies, what, 30 to 50% of the nation's food. If a dramatic climate event affects California and the food supply, well, we better have a strong local food system to be able to make up for that difference.
One of the things about climate change is it's coming, and so we need to, as farmers and as cities, prepare for it intelligently, and especially around the food system. There are likely going to be interruptions to our national and global food supply. How does that affect availability here? How does it affect pricing here? If we have multiple sources to get our fruits and vegetables and meat and dairy. If we have a strong local community, that local community can step up production, hopefully, when California's production or Florida's production or Mexico's production is interrupted. And if our local food supply gets interrupted by similar kinds of events, we then have open channels to national sources. So resiliency really isn't having lots of plan A's, plan B's, plan C's, so that whenever something hits, you've got a backup plan.
I just heard that the olive crop in Italy has been destroyed by a parasite. And so now we're going to be having trouble with olive oil. But then if you had another crop over here, maybe people would eat that more instead of the olive oil.
Sunflower oil is something that's being produced more in Kansas in particular. So development of those regional supplies of oils also is going. I mean, I love my olive oil. I will never stop cooking with olive oil. But at a certain point, you might want to be able to source regionally for alternative oils because of situations like that.
So what are some other strategies that you can use to cope with climate change?
Soil, it tends to be my answer for every question. Really healthy soil is a a good buffer to a lot of climate change issues.
Some of the other strategies that are useful for farmers is climate controlled environment agriculture, so use of greenhouses, use of low tunnels, use of shade cloth, because that all mellows out the sun, protects against excessive winds and rain. Being connected to city water, not relying entirely on rainfall, doing more rain capture. So if we're getting all of our rain in 4 rain incidences, if you've got tanks to capture and save that rain and hold on to it till you need it, that's a great resiliency strategy. Are there other ones, Mark, that you can think of?
Keeping the soil covered, using leaves, using mulch, using cover crops. You want to always prevent the erosion of your soil.
Well, I was driving through Nebraska to go to a convention, and I saw a lot of crops that were growing, and I noticed that they were doing it more to contour to the land rather than just doing everything in straight lines, and that was relatively new.
Contour farming has actually been around for a really long time. It's harder to manage because you've got to, you know, plow on the curve, you've got to till on the curve, but it works better for slowing down and holding water, and so there are more farmers adopting that. More farmers are using what's called keyline. And Mark, I'm going to ask you to explain this.
You're trying to identify how the water moves on your land, and then you'll cut these thin, deep, I guess for lack of a better word, ditch. But it's not a ditch. It's a real thin cut through the land so that water will sink in and stay on your property longer. And you can then using those lines to direct where water moves a little more.
I want to call out one more set of resiliency strategies. So both consumers and farmers need to be involved in policy issues, and because the behavior of our federal government, the behavior of the USDA, our state departments of agriculture, they all impact your ability to farm in ways that promote climate resiliency. And so funding for programs that train farmers in cover cropping and soil building, funding for programs that help farmers get loans to buy no-till equipment on our bigger farms. So getting engaged in climate change issues is really important right now. So like one of the things we're doing is we're involved with the Climate Action Council of Greater Kansas City, which is a group of elected officials and city staff and county staff that have come together to develop climate change. And we're working with them to make sure that food and agriculture is incorporated into the sort of suite of options they have in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and sequestering greenhouse gas emissions.
So you've got your the farm here, and you're doing some things to help make the soil really good here in Westport, right?
Yes. We are building the farm on a former sports field that has had, you know, basically just waste grass and has been mowed heavily and probably had a lot of chemicals put on it. It was designed for the water to run off as quickly as possible, as sports fields are. And so what happens is whenever it rains, all of the organic matter in the soil floats up to the surface and then floats away with the water, and you're left with clay. Clay is actually very nutrient-dense. It's really good for the plant, but they have a hard time getting their roots through it. And so what we're trying to do is to use the microorganisms that live in soil to actually take that clay and organic matter and all those things and make soil for us.
One of the things that's great about urban farming is you have access to surplus resources in the city. So that includes leaves from people's yards, it includes wood chips from, you know, tree cleanup. So Dan has done a really good job of getting tons and tons of leaves donated and delivered to our farm. We've been working with Missouri Organic Recycling, which does composting of urban food waste and urban organic waste, and we've been spreading that all over the field. So those are some advantages to being in the city that's harder for people in the country to access, rural farmers to access.
So what we're doing is we're laying leaves down on our clay. We're tilling the clay one time to get some roots down into it. We're plugging plants into that, and then we're inoculating the field with compost and soil, and then we're going to stand back and just let the process take its course.
So was that what you'd call cover cropping?
Cover crop is doing is it's actually feeding the soil in between times when you're growing your main crop. So when a farmer plants his corn crop, about 100 days later it's done, harvest, and then they just leave the field sitting blank. All of that microbiology that's living in the soil starves to death. So one function of cover cropping is to feed that soil microbiology throughout the entire season. The other effect being that it'll reduce erosion just by the simple fact that the roots are there. And then the other thing it does is it adds organic matter to the soils.
Well, what distinguishes a cover crop really
sure.
is that the intention is not to harvest it. The intention is to knock it over, till it into the soil, let it rot onto the soil surface, because then it adds to the soil health. Grazing animals is another way of using cover crops. So they move across the field, they graze, their feet work the soil and aerate it. They also poop and pee all over the field, and that adds nutrients.
So that's what you're doing right now to build up the soil in the Westport farm, and then eventually you'll plant something else there?
It's the central part of the field right now. It has cereal rye. When it reaches the flowering stage, we'll mow it down, and then that will become a mat of mulch on the soil, and then we'll plant crops into that. So mostly melons and winter squash and things like that. And all of that will rot down and will feed the soil.
So we're building the soil. We're growing some vegetables. We're growing some flowers. We're growing some cover crop. It's going to be really beautiful. It was really beautiful last year, and we expect it to be even more so this year. Long term, what we want to do is raise money to build a greenhouse. So going back to that climate resiliency strategy, we want a greenhouse on site that is growing food and transplants year round. We want to put in a couple of high tunnels, again, for season extension and for year-round production. We want to put vegetables and flowers and herbs and fruit out in the field. We just yesterday got a bunch of fruit trees planted right adjacent to the field, so we're going to be looking for fruit and orchard crops from that. We want this to become a demonstration site so people can learn about agriculture. We want it to be a place where folks in the building or folks in the neighborhood say, oh, let's go have our lunch over at the farm, and we'll have a gazebo there and a picnic table, and they can sit in the midst of all this growing food and enjoy their lunch and learn and engage with agriculture. So we really want it to be a neighborhood-engaged farm. We want people to think of it as, oh, that's our neighborhood farm, and we want them to start understanding that, oh yeah, every neighborhood should have its own farm. Every neighborhood should have its own community garden. You know, food production should be part of our understanding of what a healthy city looks like.
So I know you have the Westport Commons site, but you have two other sites too, don't you?
So we have over in Merriam what's called a food forest. It has been around for maybe 9 years now, and it is a half-acre site that is planted to fruit trees and berry bushes and herbs, and we've got strawberries over there and fig trees. We've got nut trees as well. We've got chestnuts over there. So it's a system of planting where you're really paying attention to the relationships between the different plants, the height of the plant, who's next to it, who needs nitrogen, who provides nitrogen. So it's a really amazing site that we often will do tours for.
How is that different than a garden?
So basically, if you imagine a forest or a woodlot near your house, there's a community of organisms that are in competition, really. They're trying to find space. They're trying to produce nuts or fruit for themselves. Well, a food forest, the idea is to take that structure and then every single plant you plant in it mimic that structure, but it's also a plant that produces food for people or is a pollinator or an attractor for pollinators. So the idea is that you're trying to mimic that community and do as little work as possible to maintain it, so it's sort of it sort of takes care of itself because everything's sort of fitting into a niche. There's no real way, by the way, to completely create a garden that you don't touch because everything's always in succession. And one of the cool things about food forests is that you can, if you plan it correctly, you can have a harvest going on almost every month of the year from different fruit trees because they fruit at different times and the food becomes available at different times. It's a very interesting concept and one I don't think that anyone's quite perfected, but we're definitely trying. So
I don't think they'll ever perfect it because it's so site specific. It requires a lot of planning, a lot of knowledge, and a lot of time and a fair amount of upfront investment. And so it's a system that you have to be really committed to.
It's like diverse ecosystems are more resilient. A monoculture system, it has the threat that it could break down easily and have a catastrophe. But have diversity in your plant life, diversity in your pollinators and your beneficial insects that come in. So more plants, more pollinators, better resilience, more to withstand changes to our environment.
Yes, you don't have any potato famines or anything like that because you're planting one particular plant everywhere.
Mm-hmm. That's a great, a perfect example and one that everyone knows. And a thing that you could add to the potato famine story that most people don't realize is that the Peruvians who domesticated potatoes, who gave the Europeans the potato that eventually became the famine potato, had dozens of types of potatoes that they had bred over the years. We planted one type and it became susceptible to the blight and took them all out. So that's exactly what Mark is talking about. When you have a diverse system, there's more chance of resiliency. And what I found, even out here, just in one season of our cover cropping, when you have different species growing next to each other, the plants behave differently than they do when they're in a monoculture. So one of the things we did is we planted cool season crops in the heat of June in a very, very dry year, but we planted them along with plants that love the heat and don't mind growing when it's a little bit dry. And what we found was that those cool season crops, like the like the canola plants and the collards and things like that, lived underneath the shade of those bigger plants and were actually able to survive the heat of the summer. And then when those tropical tall plants died back, they took over. And right now in our field, we have canola plants that are blooming that lived all through last June and into the winter and all through the winter, and now are out there blooming and happy because they had the interaction of the plants next to them. So take that little concept and then apply it to a farming system.
When we look at diversity and when we look at resiliency, we're looking not only at one specific farm, but we're looking across the system. And so diversity really happens in space, and it also happens in time. Okay, let's look at our region. You know, what all do we have here? Do we have livestock? Do we have corn? Do we have grain? Do we have vegetables? Do we have fruits? Do we have food forests? So that we are really, we're not putting all our eggs in any one basket, and we've got backup plans for everything.
It doesn't have to be that every individual farm has all those things.
So the whole food system for Kansas City, if you have a lot of things available, then if one crop doesn't make it, there's something else we can eat.
It seems weird to be having conversations about this level of food system collapse. And, I always feel a little bit like I've slipped into a sci-fi movie or something, but the forecast is pretty grim. And so So we need to be having these conversations, and to some degree we need to be assuming worst case scenarios so that we are pleasantly surprised if it isn't as bad as we thought it might be.
Well, it's even something I was considering when I was going to contact the American Arborist Society and get some trees to plant in my yard, because I heard part of the cause of global warming is the deforestation. And so if you plant a lot of trees, that's something you can do to help. But what should I plant? Because the climate's changing right now, so something might be okay for this zone right now, but in 5 years, is that going to be okay?
We used to be a zone 5. We're a zone 6A now. We're creeping up. We're predicted to become a zone 7 within 10 years. So it does creep up.
You know, maybe I'm thinking too much, but that's something I've been aware of.
I don't think you're thinking too much. I think it makes perfect sense to be really considering, especially with a long-term, you know, like a tree is around for decades, and, mm-hmm. and you want to be thinking about what's the situation it's going to be growing into.
You know, farmers become the answer to a lot of our problems. The vast majority of people have no idea where they're going to get food if they can't go buy it at the store. Now suddenly Catherine becomes the most powerful person in the tri-state area because she's a farmer and she can feed you, right? So a farmer is a solution. You know, if you talk to climate scientists, they say if we stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere today, we're still going to melt the ice caps. We're still going to have this huge climate tragedy. But that's not technically true because we can remove CO2 from the atmosphere by doing just what you said. When you plant a tree, it's taking the sunlight and it's taking CO2 from the atmosphere and it's using it to build its roots, it's using it to build its trunk, it's using it to build more leaves, it's putting some of it down in the soil to feed the soil food web. We're sequestering CO2 in the soil. Farmers are the answer to climate change, literally. If we change the way that we're doing our farming now to one that matches more what we're modeling here on this farm, you can sequester huge amounts of carbon, enough to save us, to stop that from happening.
I think that that's absolutely right. We also, though, because farmers are people who are trying to make a living and feed their family, we have to help figure out the economic equation for them. And that's one of the reasons why policy is important, because changing your practices entails financial risk. So we need to really integrate an understanding of agriculture as a way to sequester carbon with agriculture as a way to feed our families and to take care of ourselves. And so that's where policy comes in. That's where urban-rural conversations happen. That's where we really need to be creative and open-minded and help each other make choices that we might not normally make.
Well, thank you very much for all that information. That's the end of our show for today. I'd like to thank Catherine Kelly, Mark Gowron, and Dan Kroll for taking the time to talk with me today. On the KKFI website under Radioactive, you can look up a description of today's show that includes links to Cultivate KC. You can also listen to today's show again and get information about upcoming shows. This is Lynn Marie Norris with Radioactive Magazine on 90.1 KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
And thank you for tuning in to Radioactive Magazine. Next week on Radioactive Magazine, we have Juvenile Justice Reform in Kansas. Mike Fonkert of Kansas Appleseed joins host Craig Lubow to discuss juvenile reform in Kansas.